Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and I'd just been chatting before the show with Chris Loa, and now I'm doing it live. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Dennis. How you doing again?
So nice to talk with you. Listen, I want to talk a little bit about the world first, the world of acting. When you got into performance, when you got into the performing arts, and how that has evolved from the idea of the actor who sits around and goes to auditions and calls his agent up to the fact that you have to be an active piece of your career. And here you are as a writer, as a performer, as a director, as a producer, as a photographer. All that is much more the engagement aspect of a career than it had been before. And I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about that and how you're approaching that career, and we're off.
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. For me, you know, I think I've always been kind of a mover and a shaker. And growing up in Georgia, you know, Atlanta now is such an industry town, but when I was growing up, it wasn't.
Yeah.
And so it was really hard to kind of, there was really not a lot of acting that was going on there. And so I started getting into film production, shooting movies, making movies, just, you know, as a kid, like in my with my friends in
sure.
school. And I sort of had this thought process that I would go into film school and just continue making films and until I could just put myself in them. Ironically, when I finally did direct my first movie, the last thing I wanted to do was act in it. But so I went to film school with that intention at USC, and then by happenstance, I started acting very quickly, which was just a real godsend. And it was one of those very frustrating stories for people to hear about being in the right place at the right time and luck really playing the biggest part. But I started working a lot as an actor, and very quickly I ran into this real frustration, which I think a lot of any actor feels, which is that,
sure,
you know, acting is one of the only art forms that you can't do on your own. It requires someone else to do it. So it's not painting, it's not writing, it's not photography. It requires another person to give you the material or to act opposite.
Absolutely.
Or to direct. And so it's exactly what you said. It's a lot of sitting around and waiting for the phone to ring, which can be so depressing and frustrating because you just feel really out of control. You feel like you have no say in the art that you're creating. And so for me, after a couple of years of that, I really needed a creative outlet. And so I started taking photographs as just a kind of an offshoot of when I was on my first television show. My character was a photographer, and Dave Sachs, who was the producer of that show, gave me this beautiful old Leica camera, and I started shooting like a madman. And then I just kind of caught the bug. So for me, it began with photography being just a way of going out and expressing myself and still feeling like I was doing something productive as an artist that I had control over, that I could do of my own volition. And that really kind of clued me in to how important that was. I found myself much happier and much more confident as an artist, and as a result, I started booking jobs a lot faster as an actor. Isn't that
interesting?
Yeah, I really do think that plays, because otherwise, you know, what happened for me when I started as an actor is I booked my very first audition, which is amazing. The downside of that is that then it was for a television show. When the show finished, I just assumed I'd book my second audition, you know, which is very delusional. And then, you know, 9 months went by and I didn't book a job, which is fairly common, frankly. And I felt, I learned that if I wasn't doing other things to continue sort of feeding that appetite, that creative appetite, that I became lazier and lazier. I became less and less confident with my abilities as an actor. And so I'm definitely now kind of always trying to, I've always had a lot of balls up in the air, you know?
Sure.
And so anyway, so, yeah, please.
No, no, no. I want you to finish. I was jumping in. Continue, please.
Oh, well, I was just going to say what eventually happened was I wanted to take my photography to kind of another, I sort of wanted to branch out of photography and go into writing and directing, which is sort of kind of what it initially brought me into the world in the first place. And so my friend Mo Narang and I started writing a script sort of as an exercise and just us as collaborators to see how well we wrote together. It was never really, I don't think either of us had the intention of it really ever becoming a feature film. And what the beauty of the career I've had as an actor is I could really lean on people. So, you know, we'd write a draft and then I'd send a copy of it to Tate Taylor, who directed The Help, and I'd say, like, Tate, read it, give me your notes. And or I'd send it to Jason Reitman, who directed me Up in the Air, which was amazing.
Great.
So I was very fortunate in that regard. And then eventually I was shooting a film called Brightest Star, and the producers of that film were like, well, you know, we'll take a look at it if you want our notes. And Mo and I just said, yeah, that'd be great. And then a week later they called and said, well, we'll just make this movie if you're on board. And then all of a sudden it became a very real thing. And I just sort of knew that if I didn't say yes right then and there, if I just sort of put it on pause to kind of wait it out and see how I felt, that I never would do it. So I just said, yeah, let's do it right now. And so we just went straight into casting and getting the money together and shooting a film. And so we made this movie, which is called Beside Still Waters, which actually played at the Austin Film Festival, where you and I met originally in Austin. And the film went on to win both the jury prize and then later the audience award, which is spectacular. And we're actually now going to be coming back to Austin in a couple of weeks to do an encore screening of the film on March 3rd, also through the Austin Film Festival.
How cool. That excites me. That excites me so much because when you sat down, with Mo and said, we wouldn't need to make this movie, what was it, what was your impetus? What was the impetus, the idea, the concept? What was driving that?
Well, it's funny, now that we've actually just finished writing our second film, which is going to, again, through Austin. Austin has been very good to us.
Monday
the 3rd, yeah. It's a great place. Monday, March 3rd, they're doing an encore screening of Beside Still Waters, and then on Tuesday the 4th, they are doing a public reading, which I think is free to the public, of our next screenplay, which is called Isolation Tribes, which we are basically going to just read the script out loud and kind of workshop it. I'll be asking questions for the audience to kind of get their feedback. But what Mo and I learned, especially after having written the second one, is that the writing that the movies that we make, that we will continue to make, will at least have some basis, some root in our real lives.
Thank God.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I actually have a great deal of respect for filmmakers who go completely outside of their own world. I think it's just a fascinating way to tell a story. But, you know, for me, I've kind of decided that, you know, there's no right or wrong way to be an artist. It's just sort of you're an artist the only way that you know how to be. And for me, as a storyteller, I think the way I really know how to tell a story is if it's my own, or at least if I can connect to it on a really personal level. And so Beside Still Waters was born out of Mo and I wanting to write sort of a love letter to our youth, a love letter to the place that we grew up and the people that we grew up with. So, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Georgia, we had this house, our family had this house on a lake where I spent all of my summers and where all of our friends spent all of their summers, and it was kind of like the epicenter of our childhood. And a few years ago, my parents ended up selling the house because they had to move away. And when that happened, I had a complete meltdown. I actually ended up moving back to the house for the 31 days of escrow and just basically, chaining myself to the floor. And actually, it was actually a great prolific artistic period because I did a huge photography series during that time. I basically invited anybody who had ever, sort of been a part of that house come back, and I did a whole portrait series. And then while we were there, we sort of finalized the script of The Size of the Waters, and it was a really cathartic kind of closure for both Mo and I and all of our friends it was amazing. I had Emma Stone flying in and to rural Georgia to come read this script with us. It was like people really, everybody kind of came through for this because I think they all knew both what the house and also what this movie meant to me. And so that was really the impetus for writing the film was to sort of write this kind of testament love letter to the place and people that we grew up with.
So what did you learn about yourself and going forward about being a director? Because doing your first feature film must be an extraordinary experience. I've done some directing, and I know that the minute that somebody says, okay, this is yours, and go forward, it's an extraordinary piece about learning about myself. So what did you learn about yourself, both as a person and as an artist, during the directing of your first feature?
Well, I think first thing I learned, and thank God, is that I really love directing. That would have been a real backfire if on day two I'd made a huge mistake. One of the things I fell so in love with it, in fact, that there were a couple days there where I thought I was going to maybe give up acting altogether and just direct because it surprised me just how fulfilling an experience it was. I had this fear that I was going to be jealous or something of the actors who were on camera because I would want to be doing that scene or that performance when in fact it's just like a completely different muscle group. It just feels like a totally different high, which I love. So I love just watching, really just sort of sitting back and watching other actors do very good work. I mean, I learned a lot about acting as a result of directing, which was really nice. And I think probably the biggest reward of it all is that part of the reason I really got into it in the first place is because I wanted to talk to actors the way that I wish a director would talk to me. I think so often, actors have, every actor has his or her own way of getting to where they need to be for a performance, right? So Daniel Day-Lewis, needs to be alone for a month by himself, and when he shows up on set, he stays in character, and people refer to him as his character name. And doing all of that allows him to show up on set on the first day and know that he has done all the work he can possibly do, and it gives him the confidence to give a performance that he gives, right?
Yep.
By that same token, George Clooney, on the other hand, he rolls in and he's like buddying up with every single member of the crew and it's all no big deal and he's very casual and fun-loving and easygoing. And as a result, when it's time to shoot, he already feels like he's in a really safe environment and therefore gives him the confidence to feel like he can take whatever risk he's going to take as an actor. So those are like two radically different approaches to the same result, right? So I think, and I don't think any way is right or wrong. Again, I think artist, you're an artist however it makes sense to you. So when it comes to acting, I think whatever allows you to show up on set and be as confident as possible is the best thing, right? What I think a director's job is, I think the mistake a lot of directors make is that they decide, well, this is the way I direct. I direct just this way, in the same way that an actor is like, this is how I get into character. I think when directors sort of say, well, this is how I direct, it ends up shutting off certain actors. So for me, I think the best thing a director can do is learn what is basically as quickly as possible learn what each actor needs to make them feel that confidence on set. So you sort of you direct, you know, you learn to kind of adapt depending on which actors you're working with. So some actors I learned very quickly needed to be coddled. Other ones needed to be left completely alone. Others needed a lot of rehearsal and a lot of reassurance. Others needed, like, just wanted to show up and do it in the moment. And I think the better I got to know each of my actors, the better I was at my job of getting the best performance I could out of each one of them, you know?
God, how long did it take to shoot your first the first reels?
Not the first day.
I'm talking about until you went into final. I don't know if you did. You have to go back and reshoot, or did you get everything in the can?
We got it all. We did principal photography. Was the entire film we shot in only 18 days, which is insanity.
Wow.
We did 3 6-day weeks, so it was a real sprint. And we were shooting on film, which today is like impossible.
My goodness, are you kidding?
It's like if I can handle that, I can handle anything. No, film is a big deal for me. As a photographer, I've always shot on film, and I think there's a real philosophy that comes with shooting on film versus digital, which I wanted to bring to this particular story. And you know, frankly, I had very hardworking producers who were able to make that possible on such a low budget. So it was, but needless to say, it was, you know, the stakes are really high when you're shooting on film.
Amen.
And it was great. I think the result is really palpable for audiences.
So cool. I have so many questions, Chris, which is one of the reasons why I keep stepping on your lines.
No, Chris, please ask away. I'll try and be more succinct.
How is your temperament in the editing room? I don't think anybody realizes that hasn't done it what it takes to go into that damn editing room and work and go, okay, wait a minute, you know, 3 frames this side and put it there, and oh, how does this work? No, that way. How is your temperament in that editing room with your editors? And tell me about that experience.
It's funny. I thought I was really going to hate the editing process because it is, like you say, it's so meticulous and it can be so boring. But I think because, again, I'd done so much editing on my own when I was studying film production that I kind of knew the language, so I didn't feel completely useless. And I actually found it to be like an extremely rewarding process. My friend,
isn't it though?
It's amazing. One of my best friends is this guy who wrote, his name's Will Reiser, and he wrote this movie 50-50, which was a spectacular film that came out a few years ago. And Will, and this is sort of a common thing, but I remember him telling me very early on, you have the movie that you write, and then you have the movie that you actually end up shooting, and then when you get to the editing room, you have a completely different movie that you end up finally making. And I don't think truer words were ever spoken. You know, I mean, what Mo and I first wrote on the page, you know, when you hear that actually come out of an actor's mouth, and with the blocking, it completely changes. And then when you get into an editing room and you're actually looking at it, you realize, like, oh, this doesn't work at all, or this needs to be much shorter, or we need to drag this out longer, or, you know, I mean, it totally changes. And that was, like, for me, you hear that and you think that there's only so much you can do in an editing room. You'd actually be surprised. And it's a really fascinating way to...
Oh, God, yeah.
It's a great part of the process. Also because... You know, when you're shooting, you don't have a single minute to breathe. It's just like constant go, 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 go. There's no time to really sit and think. And what's nice about editing is that's like the one time in the process where you can actually like really take a second and meditate on even the smallest, most trivial little choice, which was nice.
And do you get to that point? Did you reach that point when you're, okay, enough futzing with it. I can actually let this go, because in order to let something go and say, okay, done.
Right. Right.
How do you hit that point? Because that's a really nuanced place.
Well, I think, you know, they always say, like, you never finish an art piece, you just stop working on it or whatever. I mean, I think I could have probably continued editing that film until there was no film left. In the same way that Mo and I could have continued writing the film until there was no film
exactly.
left. I honestly, I feel like there's, like, at a certain point, you not only, at a certain point, the film, in terms of rewrites, I learned quickly, like, at a certain point, the film is just getting different. It's not necessarily getting better. And, in fact, at a certain point, I think it starts getting worse because
exactly.
you've lost, like, any of that initial excitement and enthusiasm and joy that went into those early drafts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with editing. And honestly, I do feel like the draft that we ended on, I mean, the draft that you see when you see the finished product is the best version of the film. It does feel like,
okay.
you know, the most complete, the most succinct story that we could tell, which is rewarding. I mean, you know, I have this fear every time I sit down to watch it at a screening or at a festival that I'm going to hate it all of a sudden. And so to see it still and be like, oh, I'm really proud of this. This is something that, like, I really am, like, proud to say is mine is a really nice feeling.
God, what an exciting thing for you. And so how have you and Mo been able to work on your collaboration to be able to say, okay, that needs to be better? How do you guys work as co-writers in this process of learning?
That's a great question. We have a very unique process. I don't know anybody else who does it this way. And again, it just is for us. It's the best thing to do. The way Mo and I work is we get together, we write a very, very detailed outline together. Right? We go back and forth. We write it all down. And then once we have our outline, we go off and we each write an entire screenplay by ourselves.
Wow.
So Mo writes a full-length screenplay on his own, and I do the same thing. And then we send those to each other and read each other's, and then we basically take them and sort of create kind of a Frankenstein monster out of the two, and that is sort of a full, that's what we call a draft, you know? And
yeah.
What we love about it is, you know, so often when you're writing with somebody, they might suggest something that you don't really understand or you don't really like initially, so you sort of shoot it down. And then that idea never gets to really be explored. Whereas when you're writing, when you get to write it by yourself, you get to really, like, kind of run with whatever that idea is. And since we've already created the outline, it's not going to stray too much from the story you're trying to tell. And so as a result, you get, like, twice the bang for your buck. You know what I mean?
Beautiful.
And one of the things that really worked for us.
What a process! And what I love is because you guys are finding your own styles and your own voice, whatever that is. I know that when I'm working on my comedy and I'm working on my writing and I know when I've hit that voice, I can feel it inside. It's a subtle thing. I really have to listen very carefully. But when it happens, I can feel it all the way through my body.
I agree. When you know it, you know it. It's a very clear feeling when you know you've, like, landed on something that's right.
Yeah. God. Well, in these last few minutes, because I know that you have another interview that you're going to, and so I need to truncate this. And please, if I'm going to annoy you, I might as well annoy you right now. Because
okay.
Congratulations on what happened at the Veronica Mars work and going back to the movie and all. But I just got to ask, what was that, myself to ask? I know you've been asked this 1,000 times, but to step into an iconic relationship like you stepped into between Veronica and Logan,
right.
and have to act that. How the hell did you approach that? And how? I mean, you've done wonderful comedy about it. I've seen some of that, but I just got to ask you myself.
I'll tell you. You know, when I got the job, I hadn't seen the show. I was auditioning. I'd heard about it. I hadn't seen the show yet, and so I remember going in and auditioning for Rob. Thomas, the creator, and he just said, listen, everyone's going to hate your character because you are essentially going to be the rift between the two big lovers on the show, but we're hoping because you're such a nice guy that they won't hate you that much. Like, okay, great, now I really want to do it. Thanks a lot, man. But it was honestly, I think it was just a blast. I mean, frankly, it really had nothing
Amen.
To do with the. I never felt any pressure of being responsible for my character being responsible for this big breakup, because all it really does is it enriches the experience for the fans to really want those two to end up back together. You know what I mean? And quite honestly, you won't find two nicer human beings than Kristen Bell and Jason Doring. So it's not like I was feeling any heat from those two, you know?
On the Kickstarter night, we're talking with Rob. Jason comes over the fence, behind the fence, and comes there and starts visiting with the fans on it, you know, coming there for the Kickstarter night before it had, as it had happened. What graciousness that happened when this was here in Austin.
Yeah, I mean that's exactly Jason. I mean I think literally this film only exists because of the fan base. So, and I think part of the reason the fans of Veronica Mars are so passionate is because all of us who worked on the show are so grateful to them.
Yeah.
You know,
it comes across. It comes across in all of your Comic Cons and different work that you do. Well, look, we've got about 3 minutes left. Anything else that you want to say? Certainly, we're going to be posting this to the boards here, and the Awesome Film Society, and we'll make sure that's out there as much. But is there anything that you want to say in these last couple of minutes before you move on to your next interview?
No, not really. I would say to anybody who happens to be in Austin that first week of March, to please feel free to come down to the screening of Besides Still Waters or to the reading of Isolation Tribe. You can find all that information on austinfilmfestival.com's website. And I'd love to, and I'll be there, and I'd love to talk with anyone who feels like showing up. But beyond
Terrific.
That, Dennis, I just want to say thank you for asking such great questions.
Well, thank you, Chris. I've been wanting to interview you for so long and to have this first conversation with you. And also, along your career, I won't hold you to this, but I'll pretend I am, that as you continue to make films along your career, I'm going to want to continue to talk and to learn, know more about what you're learning about yourself as an artist and as a performer, and see how that goes along the road.
Well, look, I look forward to it as well. I, the questions are as good as these. I'm happy to answer them.
Amen. All right. See you in Austin when you're here. Take care, Chris.
Sounds good. Take care. Bye-bye.